Hello and welcome to Fueling Around with me, Jason Plato, and the champagne on my podium. It's Dave Vitti.
Hello.
Hi, Dave. How are you, mate?
Very good. Thank you, JP. You're looking, well, I mean, enchanting, I think is the word.
Enchanting? Mate, yeah. Let's just move straight on because that's nonsense. Now, as you know, Fueling Around is powered by Adrian Flux. As the UK's largest specialist insurance broker, Adrian Flux will tailor a quote to your exact needs and help save you money on your car, your bike, or even your home insurance. So then, Dave, forget all that nonsense. Enchanting. What have you been reading?
There's just something enchanting about you today. I don't know what it is. I don't know whether it's those sort of intriguing spectacles or whether it's your resplendent sterling hair. I don't know what it is, but there's just something about you. But it's not about you today, I have to say, because you, like me, are excited because we have a special guest on the podcast who is going to give us backstage access.
We
inside stories, that kind of stuff. You know, the stuff that we like, you know, like the juicy gossip.
Money can't buy stuff.
You're not kidding.
Yeah. Well, our special guest today, well, she's a presenter, a journalist, and also an author, no less. What she doesn't know about Formula One and motorsport in general, frankly, isn't worth knowing. She's been a good friend of mine for years, and I'm delighted to have her on my podcast. It's the one, the only, with simply the most gorgeous voice in all of broadcasting. It can only be Lee McKenzie. Hi, Lee. How are you?
I'm very good, thank you. Of all these stories and gossip and backstage access, I think about 90% of them are going to be about you.
Well, the thing is, Jason, you do have something of a reputation. I mean, we've worked together for a good few years now. And actually, what Lee is implying here is stuff that has been implied by many people before, whereby normally, if there is some kind of to-do going on backstage or
shenanigans.
Shenanigans is a good word. Yeah. Normally, you are never very far away from it. Is that fair to say?
It is fair to say, and I was given a mantra by my dad many, many years ago. And it goes like, if you're going to get wet, you may as well go swimming. Do you know what I mean? And I've kind of stuck by that all the way through.
Well, it suits you.
Anyway, it's not about me. Lee, tell us what's been going on. Tell us about this book. Book's just come out.
Oh, my goodness. It's times like this, I wish I just did what the rest of the UK did during lockdown and just drank or made sourdough. But here I am.
We both. Out.
Actually, maybe I drank during writing this book. No, it's been good fun. It started off with an idea. I was asked to write an article about Lewis Hamilton. And as I was doing it, I thought, I wonder if this could be something a bit bigger. Mm. Maybe talking about several of the drivers who I've worked with really closely over the last decade or so. And it was like the party that grew before I knew it. I've got a book out and I'm sitting here talking to you guys about it. So it's exciting. It is nerve-wracking as well. But I think on the whole, it should be more exciting than nerve-wracking. It's done now anyway. I can't do anything about it.
Hey, so tell me, I'm a one book author. Do you know what? It's quite something to do, isn't it? So how long did it take? When did you start prepping? Did it get difficult? Did you have good days, bad days? Tell us the story, because it's not easy, is it?
No, and I'd been asked before to write a book about me, which I wouldn't do that because A, it would be dull, and B, you know, I haven't earned the right. I love my job. I do Formula One, I do Wimbledon and, you know, rugby and equestrian. Mm. And I love my job and I facilitate trying to get the best out of people on camera and present it as well as I can. Mm. But what I love about motor racing is the cars and the drivers, and they therefore should be the story. That was what was going on in my mind. So it's actually seven drivers, and it's me taking you through their careers, but using my interviews and experience and crazy things that have happened over the years to tell those stories. So it was quite research intensive. Yeah. And in fact, I got Ben Edwards, the commentator, who's great. Yeah. I mean, when you need anything fact-checked, go to like a responsible human being, Yoda. Yeah. Go to someone who's really much, much more responsible than the person trying to write it. And he was great because, you know, my memories of things are quite subjective. Obviously, race results are there in black and white. Yeah. But then the rest of the experiences are my own. And it was all sort of driven from, you know, people get so excited at the moment about Drive to Survive, and I completely get that. But to understand what you're seeing now, and you'll appreciate this, Jason, that you've got to know the story of a driver. You've got to know where they started from, what their hardships have been, if they won championships when they were 20 and they've never won another one since then. Yep. You know, Fernando Alonso, 2005, 2006, had the world at his feet. And it's it was heartbreaking writing his chapter in many ways. Yeah. So to give context to what people are watching now, I wanted to remind them of where these guys have come from. So if Sebastian or Fernando wins by the end of the season or gets on a podium by the end of the season, that's momentous because it's been so tough for so long. Sure. If you just watch a Drive to Survive, you think that Seb's a, you know, average driver with dodgy hair. You don't think he's a four-time world champion. And I think a lot of people forget that. And something that's even journalists and people have said to me is that it's reminded them, because Formula One and motorsport is so fast-paced, it's actually reminded them of some of the sort of madness and the things that have happened. So, you know, that's something.
That's the stuff we want to know about. And I know it because I'm in the industry and you mentioned a lot. You know, you mentioned Alonso. Would it be right to say I've got a human man crush on Fernando? Absolutely. I think he's incredible. But you're right. If you only look at the results of late, maybe the last 4 or 5 years, and you watch that Drive to Survive, you wouldn't perhaps frame that in your head. And yet he is he's one of the world's greatest ever and a really interesting guy. Likewise, all of their stories behind the scenes are really interesting. So I think it's a fantastic concept of a book.
We should mention the drivers in question. Obviously, you know, the names that we're banding around here, and just to give it some sort of gravitas and the access is such an important word, I think, is the fact that, you know, Michael Schumacher, Lewis Hamilton, Sebastian Vettel, Max Verstappen, Fernando Alonso, Felipe Massa, and Jenson Button. I mean, it's an absolutely all-star list. What I was going to say to you, Lee, was that surely the key to this book, and in fact, the key to your success generally in terms of your career, is one word, isn't it? Isn't it trust? Because in order to, you have to gain the trust of whoever you're sort of shining a light on, don't you? Because otherwise they're not going to give you the access and they're not going to give you the stories. And I think often people are kind of wary of the press in every respect. So to actually be that person that names of this caliber trust and are willing to open up to you and tell their story, I mean, that's absolutely priceless, is it not?
And rare for a journalist to command that trust.
Yeah, I think it is. And I think, I suppose, I mean, we don't all sit around congratulating ourselves very often, and I don't really think we should, but Mark Webber says it, I think it's on the back of the book, that, you know, Lee spends a lot of her time interviewing me and getting me to say things I should never have said out loud, which is great, because you know, I don't set out, I'm not clickbait, I don't do anything really like that. It hopefully does come from trust, but also I'm flown around the world not to have a lovely time and go out for dinner, you know, an awful lot, which sometimes does happen. But at the same time, if I don't ask the right question on that day when I am there, I'm not going to get that opportunity again. My bosses will just haul me straight off it. So you've got to make sure you ask the question that people at home want you to ask. That's the very least you can do. Yeah. And I've never backed off from asking a difficult question. I think there's certainly a way in which to ask something. And if I was asking Lewis or Max or Seb or whoever a question, I'd probably ask the same question to them all differently, knowing their personalities.
That's interesting. Yeah. Tell us a bit more about that. Go on, that's really interesting.
But I think sometimes, you know, and it can be across all, you know, sports as well. If you know the person well enough, you know, tennis, I have to do it at Wimbledon. I'm the first on the court when somebody's won. Now, when someone's won, they're quite keen to see you. In Formula One, there's one winner and a lot of guys who don't really want to talk to you. But ultimately, you know, some people you need to sort of go in with a little ego massage or a little look. I know you've got very high standards and second isn't what you were hoping for today. And you ease into it. Where there's others that if you started that, like with Max Verstappen, he'd just be like, you know, he's so direct. He's so blunt. He doesn't care for any of this. He's just so matter of fact, which is quite refreshing as well. So you just have to know or do as much research as you can if it's not a sport you're working in, day out, and find out who these people are that you're going to be talking to in order to get the best answer.
Well, it's your job to bring out the human side, isn't it? You know, and obviously be the bridge between the stars and the viewers, the drivers and the viewers in all of this stuff, which surely is increasingly difficult in this day and age, where actually the money involved in motor racing and in many other sports, such as football, for example, you know, makes many people suggest that actually the stars in this instance aren't as relatable to the audience as they perhaps were many decades ago, you know, now that they're living in Monaco and they travel by private jet. But I suppose your skill is to actually, again, based upon trust and whatnot, is to sort of get inside these people and actually bring out the human side and the relatable sides and all of the different facets and characters of these different personalities.
Yeah, and you add in the fact that, you know, and I'm not sure if this book could be done in 5 or 6 years' time now, because everybody knows everything because of social media, or so they think. So, you know, the book starts off with a quote from Ayrton Senna that I've always really liked about the visor hiding the emotions, because it's not like a golf or a rugby or a football that when someone gets a putt or scores a try or scores a goal, you can see that emotion. The face is covered. So we've always had that barrier. And until social media came along, you've not really known the drivers apart from what you saw on the actual Formula One or motorsport program. Now you do an interview with someone and you know, you get 1,000 people saying to you, well, Lando Norris is much more chilled out when he's on his simulator or on at home, and you're like, well, yeah, he should be,
obviously.
That's just part of it. I think that's you know, everyone's carefully curating their image as well now. They're so aware. These drivers who are coming through now, you used to go to a racetrack with a driver coach, you're now going with two social media people. And your driver coach is left at home getting frustrated watching you on the television. But and you know, according to your social media, you've had the time of your life.
And interesting enough, maybe 10 years ago, probably about then, you know, I thought F1 in particular, it's, you know, the driver projection was becoming a little bit homogenized. Oh my God, it's so much more manipulated and tickled and perfect now, isn't it? Compared to where it was years ago. And even then, it seemed it was too much.
It's a difficult balance, I think, because to be authentic, you actually do have to be yourself.
Yeah.
But who is actually doing that on social media? Not many people.
Not many at all, actually. Maybe actually Lando, actually. Not Norris. But even then, that feels... Does that feel
it's hard
like...
to know. I did when I was doing the audiobook of this. I was in a studio next to Ant Middleton, and he was voicing his book, one of his many books, and he gave me a copy of a book to read of his called The Wall. And it's really interesting because when he does his celebrity or his SAS, he does it in Australia now, the celeb one he finds much more interesting, because if you're just a civilian and you sign up to be broken down, you've probably got a reason for that, and you've got less of a barrier, you have less of a wall. Whereas actually, if you're a celeb or a sportsman or a well-known person, it's almost become your identity.
Yes.
So if you go into his program, it says it normally takes him 48 hours to break someone down. And I always think of that when I see people on their social media, friends of mine even, or people could say the same about me. You know, it's you sort of post and you put up when you want to. And I think drivers absolutely are the same. That's why when Daniel Ricciardo got booted earlier on this year, I thought that was very honest. I thought he really owned that, and it was good that he put that out. That was sort of like for the good.
His little video was beautiful, actually, wasn't it? Because it was
Sebastian Vettel's announcement of his retirement. You know, that it was his debut on social media.
It was
just really, he didn't have any social media accounts until the day, because I suddenly thought,
is that right?
Social media. Yeah.
The first thing
he did was post this 5-minute video, a German version and an English version, which was incredibly powerful. I suddenly thought, well, gosh, it's taken him that long. Sebastian hates social media and everything that goes with it. So he's obviously got a future plan to try and embrace it and you know, use it for good, because that's what his legacy is going to be.
Mm. Well, do you know what? That's really interesting you say that. I don't know if you know, but I sat on the board of directors at the BRDC for, you know, Silverstone for 10 years, and not last year, the year before. Seb went, and it was Seb's idea, and he said, look, you know, I want to, you know, I want to help clear up. And he basically on the Monday went with bin liners and cleaned up all of the you know, grandstands. Mm. And do you know what? His only request was, I don't want this social media. And
really?
Silverstone actually broke that trust, and they did put something out, and he went ballistic.
Yeah.
So that's really interesting, isn't it? That's the character of the man, which I'm sure you've, in your book, you've managed to, you know, expose. That's a really interesting dynamic, isn't it? That he just wanted to do it quietly, do something, I guess, for himself, actually. That's unusual in the crazy world of motorsport.
And do you know what? You start to doubt it, don't you? I mean, instead of thinking, this is a lovely thing, you're thinking, well, why would he want to do that?
What's behind this?
What's behind this?
Is he after this?
Yeah. He's just a really interesting guy, isn't he? Really nice.
He's really interesting. Yeah. He's really interesting. And I saw a headline this morning which just said Sebastian to Audi in 2026. And I thought, I hope not. Because in actual fact, I think he's been through so much recently. And he is a great person. I know his family, and he's a really genuine, lovely guy. And I'm so intrigued, you know, what he will do going forward. Roger Federer said something similar, that when someone said, what are you going to do? And he said, well, I don't think I'm going to be like Bjorn Borg, who didn't come back to tennis or Wimbledon for 25 years. When Bjorn retired, he was like, I'm done. I don't want to see this. I don't want to. And he just had to back off. Whereas someone like a Seb or a Roger, they'll drop in. They'll drop in on the big moments, and they'll do the right thing, and they'll handle it well, and they'll do it with grace and class. I suppose everybody has to find their own path.
Here's a great question for you, moving away from motorsport, just for a split second. The complete antithesis of those people you've mentioned. Give us the inside story on that lunatic Australian Nick.
Nick Kyrgios.
Yes. What's the story there?
It's he is fascinating, I think.
Yeah.
He's fascinating. I did a lot of interviews with him at Wimbledon this year, you know, the first person on court. And there was one moment he'd had a big match he'd gone through, and he was just sitting in his chair, sort of head in hands. And they were saying in my ear, they were like, you need to get on court. We've got to do this interview. Mm. But he was just so in a moment, and he's an interesting person. And I just, for whatever reason at that time, thought, if I hurry him, it's just, you know, he'll do it because he has to do it. But I just stayed off the grass, and they were like, I could hear the commentators feeling. I think they hated me. I can see them out of the corner of my eye in a little box. And they were just, get on the grass. And I stood back. And then actually Nick noticed this, and he looked over from his chair, and he just sort of gave me a little nod and waved me on. So that was perfect. We went on and we did a great interview. I just think he respected the fact that I had given him space. And then we did this lovely interview. And in the interview, I said to him, look, people might, you know, you give off an impression that this doesn't matter to you, but it really does matter. Mm. You know, he doesn't have a coach. And he actually said in the interview, I wouldn't wish that on anyone coaching me. Can you imagine what it's like to coach me? And he's got such a great self-awareness. But one of the interesting things from that, and I do feel this actually in Formula One as well, is that there was that dynamite match on the Saturday night, which was also the qualifying Saturday of the British Grand Prix, where Nick Kyrgios and Stefanos Tsitsipas, and it just went nuclear. The whole thing just, you know, it wasn't great, you know, for tennis really, but it was great if you're just dropping in on it. You were like, what is this madness? Both of those players were being followed by Netflix that weekend.
Okay.
Nick certainly was.
I can see the link. Yeah.
You start to see this. Again, it brings us back round to that sort of authenticity. And it sends people into a frenzy. You know, it sent team bosses, who we both know well, you know, it sent very intelligent people who speak many, many languages. And
it turns them into dickheads.
It just turns everyone into sort of like Love Island contestants. I don't know what's going on sometimes. Yeah.
The thing is with that, Lee, in terms of, you know, you knowing when the right time to speak to Nick and perhaps when the right time wasn't to speak to Nick. That's all experience. And it's something you can't really teach that, can you? That's just from having been there in the moment and experienced it. And I guess it's a bit of a sixth sense and a sort of gut feeling in whatnot. You, I suppose, were always destined for this line of work, weren't you? In terms of your father was a sports journalist and a motorsports journalist. What are your earliest memories as a young girl of that world of petrol and motorsport and whatnot?
I was a young kid that went everywhere to sort of get time off school. So like I had gone to most sporting events by the time I was about 11 or 12. And I used to go into...
kids. Take time off school to find and do great stuff.
Yeah, Lee's going to write out of it.
Yeah. It could have gone really wrong though. And the first thing, and I used to do work experience. This was at the Daily Express when it was like a big organization and, you know, well, like all newspapers, I suppose, sold, you know, a lot better than newspapers do now. And one of the first things I did was I actually got like just dumped at Knock Hill. And John, I did an article when I was 15 and it was actually published. I've still got it with John Cleland. John drove me around Knock Hill and I did an interview with him afterwards and it was published in the newspaper, in the national newspaper when I was 15. And I see John, you know, because he's always kicking around. It's like I saw him at Thurlaston. Jackie Stewart did a classic for his charities that I was hosting. And it was hilarious. John's just trying to like go off and do this show car run. And there was me, Dario Franchitti, Alan McNish, and we're all like sniffing around in the car. This was only a few months ago. And John was like, what is this? Get away, tourists, fans. And he's taken photos and he put it all over his social media. I've got some fans around today. But that's when I sort of first thought, this is friendly. These people are lovely. I love the noise, the smell, everything about it. And I started to get the bug.
And what year was that, Lee?
Of motorsport. Oh, I don't know when that would have been. That would have been
kind of mid-90s.
It was like the full-on big Vauxhall. He was like, you know.
Yeah.
He was the Dalai Lama. At that point, you know?
He was the big boy, wasn't he?
He was, And I think, and to be able to go to events like that and get paid just seemed like a win-win to me. I was like, this is great.
I'm in.
And I'm not, you know, I wasn't very academic in that way that actually when you're writing for a newspaper or you're writing your scripts for TV, because I always write my own stuff, you know, I love it. I think it's great because you can do it yourself. It doesn't have to be like you're writing a dissertation or something. It's just a different feel to it. Mm. And I think, you know, it's something I absolutely love.
Absolutely. Right. Listen, we have to go back to the beginning of the car history then, because, you know, this is something that we talk about. The one thing that unites everybody on Fueling Around is the fact that ultimately we're all massive petrol heads and we love four wheels and two wheels. So back to the beginning then, Lee, what was the first car? What was it like passing your test? What was the beginning?
I took two goals to pass my test, which was very disappointing. But for me,
not at all. Nothing wrong in that.
Acceptable.
Nothing wrong in that.
I think for my family, they'd be like, oh, for heaven's sake. But I was never going to be a first-time passer. That was not happening. And then I'd saved up my money, and for £1,000, I bought a Fiesta 1.1.
Popular Plus.
It was, well, I don't know if it was actually. I can't remember. It was like, it was that lovely blue. I'll remember the name of the blue in a second. And then, just to top it, I put a silver coach line along the side.
Oof.
Nice.
With your bare hands.
Did you do it yourself? My brother would have helped me. He would have helped
me. Isn't
it
great? We all remember the first little bit of detailing, extra little shazzle we did on our own cars. Isn't that great?
Absolutely.
Wow.
Isn't it madness?
And then, obviously, you did the parcel shelf. You put speakers in. You did all that stuff.
I did. I was very... Well, then... Sad story. I went off to university. So I was at university when I was 17. So I took this car to go to university and I was reporting on a rugby match in Edinburgh. I mean, Edinburgh, you could drop £1,000 on the ground and no one would nick it. It's so polite.
Yeah.
Anyway, my Fiesta was too much. Someone got so excited. I came out of the rugby match that I'd been reporting on and it was gone. And I just thought it was going to be me. So I sort of spent a lot of time running up and down this road going, where did I park it? Then I found out it had been stolen. The police phoned me the next day. They didn't appreciate my clothing because they'd left everything inside it. And the policeman told me... The policeman told me that he thought that they just used it because it was raining to get from like A to B. And then I waited at the police station. The story gets more surreal. I've waited at the police station for ages, and my background's all equestrian. And we used to have a horse box. It was an old BT lorry that had been converted. And it every day you try and get in it, something had gone wrong. Yeah. So eventually the mechanic told us how to hotwire it to get it going. Yeah. So I waited for the police to show me like the Fiesta and get it sorted so I could take it to the garage because it was a bit of damage. And in the end, I just hotwired it myself and drove off and got an absolute bollocking from the policeman, who was also very concerned as to where a 17-year-old student from Edinburgh had learned how to
hotwire. How did you know this?
But it was the AA that told me.
Is no way. They never told me that with my membership.
Well, I think it was a bonus. I don't know. I must have paid a little bit extra and you got a hotwire.
You took that extra box.
Checking my card now and seeing if it has any details about how to hotwire. Perhaps maybe that's on the online version. I'm not sure. Where does the car history go there then, Lee? What's after the Fiesta?
God, it gets quite bad.
Does it get worse than that?
It doesn't get worse. I then had a run of golfs.
Mm-hmm.
Because I wrote one off, but oh gosh,
that's okay. That's okay.
I had been to the again Knock Hill, and I'd been invited on this thing, and we'd learned how to use the skid pan and all the rest of it with the police. So as I was careering through the Lake District in a storm, thinking, "Okay, this is going to end badly. I'm not going to make it round this left-handed 90-degree bridge situation."
Did you pull the wand?
I did use the skid pan knowledge to get me through the bridge safely before I ploughed into the wall. Otherwise, I would have gone straight into a wall on a bridge, which would have been bad.
And did you introduce what is known in the trade as the wand? The handbrake.
Did you at any point use any of that? I tried to just steer through it.
So that was dead. That car died there and
that
then.
That car died, and that was a nice car. I really liked that. And then I bought my brother's, which was the same as mine, and he sold it to me for a profit. So that really annoyed me.
That's rude.
What, your brother's profited out? That's not right.
No, you can't do that to family. No. You can do that to, you know, work colleagues, family.
Yeah, it's okay to have an IOU, but you can't profit.
He was probably just 17 at the time, so he would have thought, I don't know, actually. I'm a nice sibling. He's mercenary.
What's his full name? Let's credit him.
Grant McKenzie.
The mercenary.
Right, writing that down. Grant McKenzie. Your time is up, sunshine.
So what else have I owned? I got that from my mum. You know, I come from a town in Scotland where if you have like one or two good garages, you're loyal to them. I think my mum's owned like 26 Volkswagens in her life or something. It's like, that's one of the big garages. So I think we got that.
Anything saucy? Anything, you know?
No, like, Jaguar Land Rover, I did a deal for them because I went and did 5 weeks for them in Portimao to do the launch of the I-Pace. And then part of that was a nice deal of getting cars. And I wanted to get a couple of them because I'm friends with Ian Callum and I knew he was leaving. So I wanted to drive some of his last ones. So that was nice. So when you know someone who's designed the cars and been through it, but I'm quite practical in terms, I think it's because it's like a traveling skip. There's like saddles or different things like that. I kind of need four-wheel drives for whizzing across fields and things.
Electric? Touch that world? Would you?
I live in Oxfordshire and go up to Scotland and things quite a lot. I like the idea of it. I actually loved the I-Pace when I drove it.
Yeah.
I had a Polestar for a little while earlier this year. They gave me one to try and see. And they are proper cars now. You know, I think a few years ago, or like when I've driven a Tesla, I was like, I'm driving a giant iPad and I can see a giant iPad and I don't really understand this.
They just don't look finished, do they?
I think if you're into tech, you may be like that, whereas I like cars. So I've got this little bit of I want it to at least look like a car. They don't sound like a car. I get it and I understand the point of it. And if that's the future, then so be it. But at the same time, it's not quite, I don't want to have to sit at a service station and charge up for 2 hours when I'm already on a 6 hour journey.
I'm with you all the way. The only good thing about the Tesla is you can make the, when you put the indicators on it, it can fart in the back seats for the kids. There's a mode, yeah.
Wow. I mean, why you would need that, I've got no idea. But I think
just it's keep the kids amused, I guess. Yeah,
it's interesting you say that, Lee, though, because it's something that pretty much I think we all agree on is the fact that much as we're all of the same opinion that electric is the future and we can't carry on with fossil fuels, et cetera, et cetera. But as yet, really, nobody has successfully brought that same character into an electric car, with the possible exception of Porsche. And you know, we've talked about the Taycan many times. But ultimately, it's that lack of character and that lack of connection, which I suppose is the main reason we're all sat here. You know, the main reason why those smells and that noise, and without that, it's all a little bit just clinical and it's a bit soulless, isn't it? I think
you could also say that. I mean, I've got, you know, I watch motorsport, I love motorsport, it doesn't really matter what's on, I get excited about what it is, and I dip in and out every year, and I will watch Formula E. Yeah. I've got friends who race in it. I've got friends who commentate on it. Yeah. I know the teams, I know the drivers, and I still can't quite, you know, get as excited as I would about a Formula One race about it.
Yeah.
And I don't know why that is. And I'm hoping that I'm wrong, but I don't know.
I'm not sure you are, you know. Maybe you would know who was the originator of this amazing quote, but they're bang on the money, and it's that we sell noise.
Yeah.
And I think motorsport, the noise element of it, even if you're watching on the TV, but certainly if you're there, is actually quite a big percentage of what makes it sexy. Do you think?
Yeah, 100%. And I know that they've tried to sort of like cheat it and mask it. And it's the same with other, you know, road cars as well. Mm. But there's nothing like when you can hear a car coming, or you just, you know, that sort of growl of a car when you know, it's great. It's, you know, I just remember the first time I was going to F1 was sort of mid-90s. And when they were starting them up, the ground was shaking underneath you.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
I sometimes wonder, like, if the future of automotive is electric and we were coming up with our ideal Formula One championship, therefore, does it still have a responsibility to the automotive industry? Could it not just go back to being dirty and noisy and, like, blood coming out your ears? I don't think in the world in which we live that would be allowed anymore. You know, it's just with the social conscience now, you can't do that. But at the same time, it's quite a nice thought because, you know, it's that would not be attracting Audi in 2026, put it that way. But if we had our little dream world, we'd be going backwards and forwards.
I wonder what's going to happen in, say, 20 years' time or 10 years' time, you know, with events like Goodwood and the classic cars.
Yeah.
I think they're going to be really special because I think the world will have to move on and Formula One will have to change. Hopefully it will still maintain, you know, its core principles, but I think a lot of the other supporting motorsport will probably end up going a bit electric, I think.
Well, it's interesting. I was I presented Goodwood Revival on ITV this year, and we were talking about that because a lot of these cars, you know, how long will even these cars still be going? They're trying to you know, sort of convert some of them, but it's, it takes the heart out of it a little bit, doesn't it? I mean, going back to Seb, he bought one of Nigel Mansell's Williams and has converted that. But, you know, you've got to have a decent whack of cash to be doing that sort of thing. I happened to be out for a walk in Scotland when I was up at my mum's a few weeks ago. And I just saw this thing in the paper that they're trying to find a backstory to this incredible Aston Martin, the LM4, like way back, like pre-war. And actually Darren Turner's been driving it. And he sent me a message going, what are you doing with this car? And I was like, well, I just happened to be out for a walk and I wanted to know more about it. And the guys at Aston were telling me, Steve Waddington and people were telling me, you know, it's actually the cost of keeping these sorts of things alive, because they are living and breathing, you've got to have the dedication of owners. You've got to have owners who have money. I present the historic awards at the Royal Automobile Club. I had no idea what that world was even like until I started presenting it a few years ago. I mean,
You need absolutely the old guys to look after them because they've got the not knowledge. And
but what's so nice at those awards, sorry, Dave, is that they have an award for young people who are now working in that industry, who might be working at Bicester Heritage, to try and train, you know, to recognise the fact. And it's so important, and it's so reassuring when you meet these kids who are like, you know, the kind of kids that you would see on University Challenge. You're like, I'm not sure if I want to hang around with them, but I'm really glad they exist. And it's exactly the same with these people as well. It's like they are so dedicated and focused. This is their world.
It's funny, isn't it, because with regards to cars now, regular cars, non-electric cars, there's actually nothing that is more environmentally friendly than trying to keep perfectly working automobiles functioning and on the road, if you take aside the fossil fuel element for a second. But the idea that we suddenly, you know, in however many years' time, effectively go and dump all of our cars into a huge landfill is absolute madness, you know. And actually, when there is nothing wrong with all these tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of vehicles, we should be keeping them going. Jason, is there not, you often talk about synthetic fuels. Is there not a way of, for example, with classic cars at Goodwood and whatnot, is there not an easy conversion whereby synthetic fuel could be put into an old 1960s sports car to keep it going? Or is the conversion cost and effort prohibitive?
Well, do you know what? That's my hope, really, in that e-fuels gain some traction, because that for me,
it's gonna be the most environmentally option, because then you keep the existing hardware, and obviously you then do away with the polluting element, as in the fossil fuel.
And it's the perfect solution, because, you know, e-fuel is a liquid. It's like a petroleum. So all of our infrastructure's there in petrol stations. It gets, you know, pumped into your car. That's got to be the way forward, because, you know, what whilst I do present an electric car show, I have to be careful what I say here, but genuinely, you know, if you were to look at the full circle of manufacture, of digging cobalt out the ground and the way, and the full circle, is it any better? Of course it is over the life cycle of the car.
Yeah.
But they're bloody dear. They're quite compromised to the way we live. And actually the infrastructure is not there and won't be there for many, many years to come. And, you know, if we all went out and bought electric car today, the country would stop. We can't produce enough electricity. So actually, I'm hoping there's going to be a balance. E-fuels will grow, and then actually we'll be able to run V8s and V10s and you know, and the tree huggers. Well, they can have their electric stuff.
But I also think what's interesting about electric and with batteries is, yeah, this is, you've got to try something, but this is so untested. So what happens to these cars and to these batteries when their life cycle is gone?
Exactly.
They've got to go somewhere. It's a little bit like people saying, oh, I don't smoke, but I vape. Well done. How do we know that that's any better? Because I've just seen your car filling up with like what seems like a volcanic amount of smoke. Sometimes you're walking along the street and think, is that car on fire? Should I step in? And you're like, no, someone's just vaping. It's a little bit similar. It's like, don't preach about smoking when you're vaping, because we don't know what's going on there.
It's too early, isn't it? Especially with the life cycle of cars. It's too early to really know.
I went off tangent.
It's absolutely spot on. I think it's a really interesting discussion. I can say argument, it's not an argument. It's an interesting discussion, because, you know, there is perhaps another way, you know, and the idea of let's get rid of all combustion engines and let's replace everything with electric. Well, is that necessarily the best way? And
I did an after dinner talk, or a sort of a Scottish motor trade dinner. And I just thought, a nice, you know, if you can have such a thing, a friendly night out in Glasgow. I thought, lovely, friendly night out in Glasgow. And I thought also, I was going on to say 11 o'clock, everyone was going to be smashed. And before we'd even started, literally before the starters had arrived, some government officials had been there, and they made a sort of big deal about Scotland's going to be fully electric and all cars off the road and, you know, all this sort of thing. And two people went up on stage really early on and said, 12 cruise ships, you're going to take every car off the road, and all you would need to do is stop 12 cruise ships going into Scottish water and that is the same amount.
Yeah, same
and
you just amount.
Think, hold on a second. Yeah. So it was it wasn't really that friendly. Everybody was everyone was furious before we'd even got to me or got to the main course because it like became such a big thing. But it is such a big talking point, and it will continue to be a talking point. But that's what annoys me about these things. It's sometimes it's so disingenuous, you know, like 12 cruise ships or an entire nation's worth of cars on the road. There's got to be a balance.
Yeah. And then you factor in all the freight ships around the world. And I mean, it's, you know, I mean, I suppose they've got to start somewhere, but it's a bit depressing, isn't it, really? And that we're doing, you know, everyone's doing their bit, and we're only just touching the very, very edge of it. And until we get rid of cruise ships, I mean, they should be blown up. I don't know anybody that goes on a cruise that I'd want to be friends with. Let's be, I mean, do you know anyone? Can you imagine sat on a Formica rocking thing with
Traps.
The same people?
Trapped
with whoever their names are, eating the same buffet. I mean, God.
I mean, honestly, I think it's like a living hell, like a floating hell. You know, the idea is you kind of think, God, I didn't enjoy their company yesterday at breakfast. And we're trapped on this boat for another 12 days. We haven't even got to Acapulco yet. You know, it's horrendous.
I wonder if everyone's just permanently swerving each other. Oh, there he is. Look,
he's going round the deck.
Down the deck.
So no one's getting to their destination. You know, they're not getting to restaurant 4C.
Yeah.
Oh, God.
No, I think that could well be the case. Lee, back to the book. Inside F1 is available now from all good bookshops and even some bad ones, I would imagine, as well, but is available
obviously
now.
Very bad ones, probably. Less good ones, more bad ones.
No, and is going to be a brilliant insight into the world of Formula One. As I mean, the names that you've got associated with a book are just stellar. They're amazing. Magnificent Seven, I think you've got there. Superb stuff.
Oh, without a doubt.
Before we go, we have one question that we ask of all of our guests, and we're going to put it to you because Jason.
Well, there's two quick questions, but no one answers
the one you put has been entirely okay. But bearing in mind, Lee, this is now we're on our fifth series of Fueling Around, right? So we've done 30 odd episodes, and Jason's one question, which he likes to ask, which is has been asked a few times, is entirely unbroadcastable in any territory, right? Which is why it's never made it on there.
Yeah, but it's only been answered what we all believe honestly perhaps once or twice
did you play out the answers?
Well, do you know what, we will perhaps email you the answers, Lee, at another point in a non-broadcastable one. But one question which is broadcastable is this, and that's that music and motoring we think go really well together. Yes. So we need your fantasy drive, please, Lee McKenzie. Where are you? Where are you going? What are you listening to? And most importantly, what are you in?
Well, I don't know. I literally have no clue why this has all come to mind, but I was going to say down the Baja Peninsula in a Beetle.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know why. I like it.
Is there
a Beetle run or something? Do they do the Baja?
There is a Baja Beetle thing. Yes, you're right.
Maybe,
they have those.
Maybe this is in my mind things. Because like none of these things are the answer that I would ever have given. Let's maybe rethink this. Maybe let's do...
What are you thinking about? Do you know where Paul O'Neill said when we asked him recently? He said he wanted to
Wigan to Warrington or something.
Well, no. No, he said the drive to Knock Hill, interestingly.
Did he?
Yeah.
The drive to Knock Hill. That's mostly motorway. He must go a different route.
I don't know. I mean, but most people think about, you know, the Pacific Coast Highway and stuff
exactly.
like that.
Route 101 or something
or
like that.
Down to the Keys or wherever it may be. Not normally driving to Knock Hill.
Maybe I would actually do what we used to do when I way back in A1GP days. Colin Giltrap, who sponsors like every driver from New Zealand and has been hugely successful, but also owns I think every garage apart from Ford in New Zealand, and he used to give us a car, and we would start round about Auckland, and we would drive right down to the South Island and back up again, get the ferry across. That was wonderful. Actually, I'm gonna go to New Zealand.
That sounds great.
Steal a car from Colin.
And a car, come on, what's the sexy car you're in? Or maybe not, keep the Beetle, although that's not very New Zealand-ish.
The Beetle was a terrible idea. Yeah. What car would I be in?
Let's narrow it down. It's going to be a convertible, isn't it, do you think?
In New Zealand, it's
the weather gets a bit iffy in New Zealand, doesn't it? Yeah. Ooh.
Yeah, okay. I should have thought of this. It's also a free car, let's be honest. I'm going to take whatever car I get from the car.
Ah, good Scottish lassie there.
Okay, the soundtrack.
And if it's a convertible and it's pouring with rain, then I'll feel right at home.
Okay, we're not going to let you off without the soundtrack, though. So what is going to be accompanying your trip through New Zealand?
You probably want some sort of classic rock driving tunes. This isn't a time for like Dermot Kennedy or anyone that easy down the road. You probably want to go for one of these. I would even say a sort of compilation. You could actually go like the Eagles.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or the Beach Boys.
Bit of Hotel California kicking out.
Or, as you say, like, or you could have Now That's What I Call Cruising or something like that that you get from the garage.
On cassette. Fueling around. On 8-track. New Christmas merch for you.
You heard it here first. I love it. On that note, Jason, I think you need to take us out.
Well, I'm going to get myself down the garage and have a look for them cassettes, I tell you. Well, that's about it for this week's Fueling Around, powered by Adrian Flux. As the UK's largest specialist insurance broker, Adrian Flux will tailor a quote to your exact needs and help you save you money on your car, your bike, or even your home insurance. Dave, as always, thank you to you. But a huge thanks to our very special guest this week, the one and only Lee McKenzie. Thanks,
Lee.
Thank
you very much. What a treat.
No, thank you very much, Lee. Superb. And as we said before, the book is in all good bookshops as we speak, Inside F1. Don't forget, you can get in touch with us on Twitter at Jason Plato or at David Vitti. And if you've liked what you've heard, feel free to give us a 5-star rating, press the follow button and share the podcast on all your socials.
Thanks again for listening. And, well, we'll see you next time. Ta-da.